basically in our living room, in the drawing room, we had an altar. And then gradually as the temple grew larger and more people were coming, then we got the property next door and built a separate temple, which is now a very beautiful mid-sized temple for their Lordship Shishi Radha Banki Bihari, Gornitai and Jagannath Baladev Subhadra. So myself and a younger brother, his name is Gopal Haridas. He's 2 years younger to me. And he's both of us, we were taught at home by my parents. We were schooled at home. Homeschooling it's called. And in America, it's something that's quite popular. In India, people are just starting to learn of it. But in the United States, more than 2 million children don't go to school. They study at home. And the parents function as the teacher, or several parents come together to teach a bunch of kids together. And so we were taught at home, and using a curriculum that was based largely on Srila Prabhupada's books, especially on Srimad Bhagavatam. We'd study Srimad Bhagavatam. And using that, then gradually we used to take the standardized exams and everything on a yearly basis. And eventually then, both of us, we went to university at an earlier age than usual. So I'll tell you some of my experiences about that a little bit later. But I wanted to begin with by telling a story that you may be familiar with already. Excuse me. But, you know, in the Ramayana, after all the armies, they assemble at the southern tip of, not all the armies, when Lord Ramachandra is first looking for Mother Sita, and he gets the help of Sugriva, the king of the monkeys. And Sugriva promises friendship to Lord Ramachandra, and as a result sends four different parties of monkeys and bears in the four different directions. North, east, west, everyone goes in different directions. But the party that goes to the south is very special. Because in that party, the head of that party is who? Hanumanji. Right? And Lord Ram has, already he knows that Hanumanji will be successful. So he sends that party to the south. Now all of them, they find out through various means that Sita Devi is right across the ocean in Sri Lanka. In fact, the person who tells them is the brother of Jatayu. You remember his name? Sampati. Okay. There you go. So he has the ability, he's a vulture, he can see very far distances. So he says, yes, Sita Devi is there. So anyway, the big problem is how to get across, right? So they're all trying to figure out, okay, how can we get across? And so different monkeys are giving different suggestions. So each one is trying to see how far they can jump. And they're all saying, oh, we can jump this far, like that. And there's one very old member of the group. He's not actually a monkey. He's a bear, right? Jambavant. Anyone know how old Jambavant was? How old was Jambavant? Do you know whose son Jambavant was? Who was his father? Brahma. And Brahma, of course, had his children when? At the beginning of creation, right? He's Prajapati. So, he had been born near the beginning of the creation, right? And when was this happening, this story? Treta Yuga. So how long was that? Anyone know? I don't know the exact statistics. How long is Satya Yuga? Some 2 million years maybe? Yeah? Something like that? So Lord Ramachandra came near the end of Treta Yuga. So he's already around what? 2-3 million years old? Very old. So he said, you know, when I was a young man, I could have jumped across the ocean and come back with news of Mother Sita. But now I don't have that much energy. I think I can jump across, but I won't have enough energy to jump back. So I'll be stuck there. In fact, Jambavant, he was still only in middle age. He wasn't very old. When did he show up again in the Lord's pastimes? Krishna, right? He's the father of Jambavati. And remember, he fights with Krishna in the cave, right? And neither one is able to defeat the other one. Imagine, By that time, he's now what? 4 million years old? No, maybe 3.5 million years old. Right? So much older. It's from the time beginning of creation. He's seen everything. And still, he's so powerful. He's still so strong that he can fight with Lord Krishna nonstop for so many days. So anyway, but you can just imagine how much work it takes to jump across the ocean. So everyone's trying to decide what to do, whether you can, who can do this task, who cannot. And finally, Jambavant, he has an idea. He remembers someone in their party who's just sitting away in a corner, kind of sulking or moping, trying to figure out what to do. And that, of course, is Hanumanji. And he goes to Hanuman and says, Hanuman, you can do this. And Hanuman says, me? I can't do this. How can I jump across the ocean? I'm just an ordinary monkey, like everyone else. I mean, I'm maybe the great leaders like Nal and Neel and Angad and all these people can do it. Maybe you can do it, but me, I cannot. And Jambavant says, no, you can. You've just forgotten. You don't remember. You have so much power. When you were a small child, you jumped so high that you were able to swallow the sun. You thought the sun was an orange in the sky that was worth eating. And you swallowed the sun. That's how powerful you are. And he reminds them, he tells them all the stories from his childhood. And says, Hanumanji, you can do it. Hanuman, you can do it. And as Hanuman is remembering this, his strength is returning to him. We all know, through the story of a curse, right? He forgot all his powers. And his strength is returning and returning and returning. And finally he feels inspired. And he grows and grows and grows in size. And climbs to the highest mountain on the coast of the ocean. And shouts, Jai Shri Ram! And he jumps across. The Ramayana says that when he jumps across, his force is so heavy that the entire mountain on which he's standing shatters. It collapses to the ground. And all the trees, all the animals and birds, they fly away, screaming and shouting. They don't know what's going on. And all the trees, their flowers, they come loose. And you know, when someone jumps, when something moves with great force, there's kind of a stream, a wind that follows them. And all these flowers were swept up in this wind. So as he's jumping across, he looks like a comet in the sky, Ramayana says, where he's just flying. And all this stream of flowers is flying behind him. They're very beautiful. So the point of the story here is that, see, Hanumanji, he was relatively young at that time. Jambavant, he was quite old. But here in this story, we find it's an example of the potential that we as young people have to serve the Lord, to serve Krishna. No one could do that task. Other than Hanumanji. He had that capability in him. But he had simply forgotten his capability. Right? He didn't know what he was capable of. His strength in the beginning in his childhood, it was misdirected. He was using it to taunt rishis and make life hell for them and make life difficult for the demigods and so many things he was doing. So they said, forget it. You don't know how to use your knowledge. Eventually, when he got the guidance of Jambavant, his elder, he was able to accomplish the impossible for Lord Ramachandra. So each one of us, as young people, this is a special quality of youth, of our time, is that we can accomplish practically the impossible for Krishna. And we can do things that no one else can do. That those who are older cannot do, because their time for doing those things is over. Right? Youth is the time for accomplishing great things. As long as that energy is directed in the proper way. Yeah? And this is the ideal relationship between those who are younger and older, we find in this story. Those who are elderly, their job is to inspire. They tell us, look, you can do it. You have the ability. Right? You have the capability. You've forgotten. You don't know. I know you can do it. Right? Parents do this for children. Then later on, others do it. Teachers do it. Professors do it. Right? You have the potential in you, just try to access it. That's the role of the elders, to give direction, to give guidance, to give inspiration. And it's the role of the younger people to actually accomplish things, to do things. Because the energy and vitality of youth cannot be replicated by anyone else. Right? Up to the age of 30, people have unlimited energy. You can practically do anything, right, up to the age of 30. After 30, Prabhupada says, then you should not do such intense labor yourself, but learn how to engage others. So you've done it in life and then you train others. That also requires a lot of hard work, because to engage others you have to work with them side by side. You have to show them how to do it like that. It doesn't mean like ordering. It means training someone how to do it. And then gradually you become 40 and then you give advice. Right? 50, like that. Each stage of life has a different kind of role, a different method. He said when you turn 70, then you just sit and you smile. Right? You just, life is good, don't worry. You'll be fine, everything's okay. People come to offer respects and like that. So, of course, in Krishna's service, there's no end to anything. We saw Prabhupada, he started 70 years old, he actually started working like a young man. His 20-year-old disciples were not able to keep up with him. Now, that's how enthusiastic he was. So in Krishna's service, there's no end. But the point is, youth is a time for ambition. Right? I'm sure we all have ambitions, right? You all probably want ambitions in terms of what you want to study, what schools you want to get into, what you want to accomplish in the future. But we all have ambitions. And ambitions are natural. They're meant to be there. If you look at Prabhupada, he said, my only disease is that I cannot think small. This is what Prabhupada said. He has so much ambition. He wanted 108 temples in 12 years. 70 books translated in 10 years. This is what you call ambition. Ambition is a good thing. We've got so many things to accomplish in life. The key is using that ambition for something that's not just selfish. That's not just self-serving. We can actually change the world. Lord Hanuman, he changed the world. Everyone hears the Ramayana. The most beautiful section of the Ramayana is called what? Well, I gave it away by saying the word beautiful. Sundar Kanda. Right? And it's all the story of Hanumanji. He's the hero of the Ramayana, actually. He's the hero of the Ramayana. We can change the world if we decide to do something revolutionary. If we decide to do something great with our lives. Most of the time, 90% of the youth in the world, 95% of young people, are satisfied with the same old thing that everyone's done before them. The same old life. You study, right? You study in school till you're, 16, 15? Right? You go to college, university, you get a bachelor's degree, maybe you get a master's degree. You find a job, you work in the job. What happens after you find a job? What happens next? Yeah, earning money. What happens when you start earning money? You have to get married, right? You have to get married. And then you get married, what happens after you get married? Please answer. Don't be shy. Don't be shy. I'm sitting up on this seat. It's a little awkward. I much prefer to speak to you as, just like friends. What happens when we start working? After we get married. Children come, right? The minute you get married, then everyone's after you. When you're going to have children. And children come, then what happens? Responsibilities, right? What do you have to do? Everything you did yourself, you have to do for your children now. Raise them, train them, you have to make sure they go schooling till 16 years old. Then after they do that, then you have to send them to a good university. Then after they go to a good university, you have to fund all that, give them money for everything, right? Then they grow older, then they get a job, and hopefully they get a good job, so that you can then arrange their marriage for them. Right? Then you have to get them married. Right? Once they get married, then what happens? Grandchildren, there you go. Grandchildren. Everyone looks forward to grandchildren. And then you take care of the grandchildren, and then you're after your children. Why are you not taking care of your grandchildren properly? And you're not giving them this, and you're not giving them that, and why are they not being educated? This, and the whole cycle continues on and on. This is the rat race of this world. Everyone's doing exactly the same thing. The birds, they're doing the same thing. Right? They're born, they eat, they grow, they get educated, the mother pushes them out of the nest, they learn how to fly, then they come back, they find a mate, they get married, they make their own nest, huh? That means working, earning, they make bring the straws, make their own nest, have their own babies, they raise the babies, push them out of the nest, watch them fly, and one day, they all die. This is the story of this entire world. It's a rat race. We do very well in school, we get good marks, we go to a great university, and we think, wow, I'm unique, I'm different. Look at what I've accomplished. Read my CV. It's nothing different. It's the same thing everyone's doing. Okay, maybe one person goes to IIT and the other person goes to the local university. Right? How much difference is there? Nothing. Why are both people going to the university? Same reason. Right? Get out, get a job. One person might get a job overseas, one person might get a job here. What's the difference? Because both are getting a job, earning money for what reason? To get married, to spend it on a family. And both are getting married for what reason? To have kids? The circle is exactly the same. That's a boring view of life. Right? That's really boring. It's not what we're meant for. Right? Hanumanji was never satisfied with the same old, same old. Right? He wanted to do something revolutionary for Lord Ramachandra. So he jumped across an ocean and picked up a mountain. Right? That's what you call doing something revolutionary. Each one of us, we have the capability to do something revolutionary for Krishna. And it doesn't have to be the same type, the same method. Some of us might do it by excelling in our studies. Other people might do it by becoming excellent musicians. Someone else might do it by becoming very good actors and performers in drama. Someone else might do it by becoming excellent cooks. Someone else might do it by becoming a wonderful mother or father. Right, and training amazing children. Everyone has a unique contribution to make for Krishna. And all we have to do, right, especially in our youth, is find what is the way I can change the world. How can I contribute to Krishna? How can I do something for Krishna that is unique, that is different, that will actually make me memorable in the eyes of the Lord, in the eyes of my parents, in the eyes of the devotees? That's our challenge. If you go to any university campus and you ask someone, why are you studying? You can try this sometime. You can ask one of your classmates or your fellow students or whatever. But especially, I've done this before on a university campus. You just talk to someone randomly and you say, excuse me, sir, why are you studying? And first they look at you like crazy, like, you know, who are you? Why are you asking this question? Right? But you just press them. You say, no, just humor me, just for fun. Tell me, why are you studying? And you say, half the people cannot answer that question. They've never thought about it. They've never thought. The only reason they're studying is because that's just what they're supposed to do. Like, that's automatic, you know? Like if someone asks you, why do you brush your teeth in the morning? You don't think about it. It's just like you wake up and before you know it, you're already brushing your teeth. People go through half their life, most of their life like that. Like we brush our teeth in the morning. With their eyes half closed, just doing what society told them to do. Right? I gotta wake up, I have to go get an education. And you say, why are you getting an education? Well, to make money. What's money gonna do for you? Well, I'll be able to buy things that I want. For me and my family. What's that gonna do? What will buying things do for you? Well, I'll be happy. Right? And then you say, have you ever wondered, do you think there's actually a connection between buying things and being happy? Right? And everyone, if they think about it, they'll say, well, no, not really. Yeah. You give them examples of celebrities, right? Big film stars and everything. Right? In America, there's famous cases that Britney Spears. You've heard about her here? This is a success story. Right? She's a teenager. She's practically the most famous teenager in the world, in the United States at least. There's another one that's coming up now. She's a preteen. What's her name? Hannah, what's her name? Hannah Montana? Something like that. Hmm? Everywhere you go, in every store, there's big, big murtis of Hannah Montana. Posters of Hannah Montana. You can buy towels, you can buy posters. Everywhere you go, there's Hannah Montana. Right? Now look at people like that. Right? Has it made Britney Spears happy? Right? Has it made all these, Paris Hilton and all her... I'm sure you can name so many from the Indian side also. Right? Everyone knows that these things don't make you happy. So then you ask that person, then sir, why are you studying? Right? What's the point? just because we're programmed by society. We're programmed by everyone to think, this is what you have to do. Without this, you won't be reasonable. You won't be civilized. Right? Everyone will laugh at you. It's only because of social pressure, peer pressure, that we go through the same rat race that everyone is going through. Right? And especially at our age, peer pressure means a lot. Right? For a young person, it really means a lot, what society thinks of them. But we don't have to think like that. Right? We can think out of the box. We have to try to figure out, what can I do that will mean a real contribution to Krishna? What can I do to stand out, to be unique? How can I really contribute to Krishna? Right? How can I change the world? This is what Prabhupada asked of his disciples when he went to New York. Right? All young people, right, completely frustrated with this rat race. They had already given up on it. And he said, look, you're meant for more. You can change the world. And they said, okay, let's go out and change the world. And what do? They change the world. The world is a completely different place as a result of those few young people who assisted Prabhupada in the early days. Mukunda and Janaki and Yamuna and Malati and all these wonderful, Prabhupada called them my boys and girls. They changed the world. We're sitting here today in a beautiful temple. Right, with so many programs, just because of a handful of young people. Prabhupada said, Krishna has sent me a group of young people just so I can fulfill all my desires I have to serve Krishna. He said, you have been sent by my own Guru Maharaj here. So this is the main message I want to give you today. Is each one of us, please sit down and think for once. Yes, we have to do what we have to do in life. Right? We have to study, we have to grow up, we have to, whatever we have to do, right? We have to do that. There's no doubt. But that's not going to make us unique. We have to ask the question, we should each sit down and ask the question, okay, I have to do what I have to do, but what will be my unique contribution to Krishna? How can I serve Srila Prabhupada? What will I do to help change the world? That's the idea, that's the question we have to ask. Each one of ourselves. So think about this. Think about this a little bit. How can we serve Krishna? What can we do? And then once you come up with something, once you decide on something, this is how I can serve Krishna, then we have to go for it with full faith, with full force. Sometimes then what happens? Right? You decide, oh, I want to be Krishna conscious, I want to do this for Krishna. But then what happens? Oh, all these responsibilities are there. I've got so much study to do, so much homework, so much pressure from school, right? And all these things, they conflict. But you'll see, if you do a little bit extra for Krishna, you go the extra mile for Krishna, Krishna will always make sure that all our material desires and ambitions are 100% fulfilled. He will make sure that we will not suffer in any way if we sacrifice something to serve Him. That's a fact. I've experienced this a little bit in my own experience. How Krishna always, if we take an extra step for Him, Krishna, He's so happy, He takes care of everything for us, around us. I told this story yesterday, also at the Prerna event. My younger brother, Gopal Hari, when I left to study at Oxford, he was the only son in Boise, and my parents ran a temple there, and so there's a lot of work in the temple, and often festivals would go on and events, and so much work would be there. It was basically a family-run temple, and so everything we had to do, from deity worship to kirtan to classes to cleaning afterwards, everything. So much work were there, especially during festival times. And of course, our festivals don't match up with the Western calendar. In the U.S., you don't get holidays around important Hindu festivals. And so something like Janmashtami or Diwali would show up, and big event in the temple, and the next day he'd have an exam. And he was so worried, what am I going to do, you know, how is this going to happen? And what to do, you know, there was so much work to do, and he wanted to help also. Right? So he'd spend all day and all night, and the festival would go to midnight, and not a little bit of studying had been done. And Krishna would always help. And next day someone would show up and say, oh Gopal, I heard you're taking this exam. I have some notes from last year's exam. Would you like to use them? And they show up just at the door with this. And he'd say, oh, thank you so much. And he'd study them. And next day, the professor would give exactly the same questions from the previous year. Right? And everything would be fine. Or one time, he went to classes. And he was, again, for an exam. And he had not studied anything. And when he got to the exam, there was someone had come in and said, sorry, the professor is very sick today. Your exam is postponed until next week. Right? So, Krishna, these are just small ways. Right? These are just small, ordinary ways. Even in big ways, Krishna helps. And if we're worried about something like our future, what admission to what college will I get? What career will I pursue? For those who are older, will I get married or will I not get married? If we're concerned about even big questions in life, that too, Krishna will always take care of everything. He'll always take care of everything for us. Krishna is so grateful if we do something for Him. If we go the extra mile for Him, that all our material needs, everything else, Krishna will take care of. Right? So that we have, devotees can be successful in every way. Right? Don't think that if we become a dedicated devotee, somehow something else will suffer. My family will suffer, or my studies will suffer, or whatever. My friends will suffer. No. A devotee can be materially successful and spiritually successful, both. There's no contradiction. Because the spiritual is the source of everything. Right? When we focus on the spiritual, then the material automatically follows. Everything below that is taken care of. So, this takes a little bit of development of faith. Each one of us, we can try it in our own lives. If there's something that Krishna is asking of you, or the devotees are asking of you, it's a little difficult, too difficult, right? Try doing it. Try extending yourself a little bit for Krishna. Maybe an extra round, or maybe it's some extra service. Something that maybe is a little inconvenient or uncomfortable for us. Going out on book distribution for the first time. Okay, we go that extra step for Krishna. And then watch what Krishna does. Watch how He takes care of you. And then when you see that, your faith will increase. Oh, if I do something for Krishna, Krishna takes care. And next time, we can do even more for Krishna. And again, Krishna will help. And our faith increases even more. And then we can do even more for Krishna. And again, Krishna helps. And our faith increases more. And ultimately, one day, we can do amazing things for Krishna. Completely dedicated to Him. And we know for a fact, Krishna will take care of everything. So anyway, those are some thoughts from my own experiences. Now, it's kind of a general approach, or some kind of, you know, what we can accomplish as youth, as young people, as we look forward to our life. Now, if there's any specific areas that you have questions or comments or your own experiences that you want to share or ask, then I'll be happy to take questions. My parents are also here. They can also. Would anyone like to say? Okay, go ahead. Yeah. One second. Wait. Yeah.
In school life, it's a lot of homework that is there, and many other study activities like that. We don't have enough time for Krishna consciousness. So we have to compromise in our Krishna consciousness so that we can complete our homework or our school day-to-day routine.
Yeah, that's a nice question. Problem that all of us, we've experienced. Too much work, especially in the area of study, and therefore not enough time or energy for Krishna conscious activities. That's something that will continue with us, stay with us for our whole life. Right? When I was studying as an undergraduate, I thought, life cannot get any busier than this. Right? I had non-stop exams and essays due and assignments, and professors wanted this and professors wanted that, and the teacher wanted this and that, and friends needed this. And I thought, my God, this is like non-stop, constantly. I thought, this is hectic. Right after I finish my degree, I'll become serious in spiritual life. Things only get busier and busier in life. I thought things could not get busier. When I started doing a master's and PhD, things got even busier. so busy I couldn't imagine. I thought this is the worst it can get. But it was nothing compared to when I actually started work. Then the amount of busyness, trying to manage that and Krishna consciousness, my God, it was so much. And then everyone told me, oh, this is nothing, wait till you get married. Right? And then you have to deal with the demands of another person and work your life with them, then see. Right? So now I'm married and things did get so much busier. Right? But now everyone tells me, oh, this is nothing, wait till you have kids. Right? Then life will get really busy. So the point is, things, this is the nature of the world. Things get busier and busier and busier. And I remember at some point, it was in the first or second year when I was doing, my first or second year at Oxford, it was the first year of my PhD, maybe my master's. I just realized at some point, I thought, I'm living my whole life waiting for the time when things will settle down so I can focus on Krishna consciousness. I'm just planning that one day I will live my real life. And then I realized that day will never come. This is my life. I'm living it right now. So whatever Krishna consciousness I can do now, this is what I have. Right? So my point is that things are very busy and yes, homework is there a lot and everything. But, and we have to do that. We have to be good students. We have to focus on our studies. That's a fact. Otherwise everyone says, oh, devotees are failures. That's not the point. We have to focus on our studies. But if there's determination, and if we pray to Krishna, there's always a way to make time for Krishna. Right? If you're finding difficulty finding time, you say, I don't have any time, then you stand in front of Radha Gopinath and you pray to them and you say, Krishna, I promise you this is the only reason I'm asking you. I just give me some way that I can finish my rounds every day or I can increase my rounds. Right? You'll see Krishna will show you a way you can do it. Right? Like they say, where there's a will, there's always a way. If we have a determination, it will always happen. And sometimes you might have to sacrifice a little bit in some other area, like your homework or whatever. But again, you'll see Krishna will help in that regard. So it's just a juggling act. It's a balancing act. And it's nice that you're asking this question now. Because right now, you're juggling two things. Maybe three things. Maybe, studies and Krishna consciousness and maybe something else. Family or parents, or, you know, like that. So we're juggling two or three balls. Point is, we should start practicing that now. How to juggle, how to balance. Because life of Maya will throw us more balls very soon. And then we have to juggle five and six. And if we haven't mastered two or three, then by the time we get to five or six, we'll completely freak out. It'll be too much. And then we'll just drop things. And unfortunately, one of the first things that gets dropped is Krishna consciousness. We drop that ball, oh, I don't have time for it. We drop it first. So, it's a good question. It's a good question. Yes.
Thank you, Prabhuji, for such a good class. I want to ask you one question. Sometimes due to peer pressure, we end up doing things that which are morally wrong. So what should we do to confront such situations or like that?
Because of peer pressure?
Sometimes friends tell us, it's right, it's right, it's right. Generally, at this age, we listen more to our friends and other society than what parents tell us.
Yes. So there's two points there. It's a good question. Peer pressure is a big issue. If you look at most of the problems that people have in high school and middle school in that time, it's all because of peer pressure. In America right now, it's such a huge problem. Teenage pregnancy is a major, major issue. And it's all a result of peer pressure. Drug taking is a big issue. It's all a result of peer pressure. People do all kinds of horrible things under peer pressure. So it's a very good question you're asking. There's two things. Right? Arjun, he asked the same question of Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. He says, why is it that even if a man is trying to control his senses, somehow the senses become swept away as a result of that? So the two things are, one is that we choose good peer association. Okay, that's the first most important thing. Now, one can ask, well, I don't have so much of a choice. I have to go to school and those are my peer people. Right? But there's a difference between people who you work with and people you actually have a close relationship with. Right? The people who actually we value in life, who are our close friends, those should be peer people who are devotees, who are types of people we want to be like, right? Whose association we value. So what does it mean, peer association? Rupa Goswami talks about this in Nectar of Instruction, Upadeshamrita. He says, those with whom we eat, we share food. We go to their house to eat, they come to our house to eat. Those we exchange gifts with, we give them gifts, they give us gifts. And those we speak confidentially with, we reveal our mind. You know, I'm feeling like this today, how are you feeling? And they reveal their mind in confidence, in secret. Those are what you call true relationships. So, people we exchange that kind of thing with, if those are devotees, then that'll provide us strength to face peer pressure in a public setting. Okay? Just like when I'm working in the university these days, colleagues will invite you out, say for a dinner party or something like that. And you have to go. There's some kind of obligation there. You cannot reject the invitation. So there's a lot of pressure there. Why don't you eat with us? Why don't you stay some time? Why don't you chit-chat? How about a drink? You know, there's so much societal pressure is there. But if you know that these are not actually the people I value in life, these are not the people I have a relationship with, it's only a formality, then immediately you start thinking, oh, what will my real friends say? Right? What will my real associates say? Those who actually matter to me. What will they think if they find out I'm doing this? Right? So that's the first point, that we have those who are really our peer association, those who really we value, that is devotee association, association we want to be like. Right? And second point is, okay, in situations where we're in a situation where there's a lot of pressure, right, there we tap into our determination, our pride as a devotee of Krishna. Right? Prabhupada said that pride is normally a very bad quality. But in one area, it's very good to be proud. Namely, that we should all be proud that we're servants of Krishna. And we have to try to cultivate that pride in us. Because the world, the society will send so much heavy pressure. Again, this continues from school to work. So much pressure is there. Family pressure, everything for so many people. Right? So we have to be very proud that I'm serving the greatest person in the world. My friends are the best people in the world. We have to have pride in that. And that pride will give us confidence. You look at pictures of Srila Prabhupada. He always walked with his head held high. It didn't matter if he was meeting a head of state or he was meeting a great scholar or professor, anyone. Made no difference. He was always the one who was in control. Not because he thought he was in control, but because he was representing Krishna. And he felt it. He knew it. That I'm a representative of Krishna and therefore I can walk with my head held high. Everyone used to say Prabhupada, even though he was materially speaking so short, he always seemed like the tallest person in any group. And there's a presence there. There's a presence. You know, in English they say there's two things. Some people demand respect and other people command respect. Right? You've heard this before? Those who are proud, like materialistically proud, they demand respect. As Vaishnavas, we never do that. We don't demand respect. We then amanina mana dena kirtaniya sadahari. But as servants of Krishna, if we see ourselves that I am dasa, I am servant of Krishna, we will command respect. Right? In other words, we can go in front of our, and we should always remember ourselves. Try this. Do this on a regular basis. In between, during the course of your school day or your homework or whatever, every few minutes when your mind wanders on something, remind yourself that I'm here only as a representative of Krishna in whatever I do. I've tried this on many occasions. It works so nicely. Like if I'm going to a big conference or something and I have to give a presentation, and I'm very nervous because I have to make a presentation in front of a class or in front of other professors and something, then before that, I try to find some place, a quiet place, and even if I can, then just in my mind, and remind myself, look, this is not about me, right? I'm here only as a representative of Krishna. Right? please Krishna, wherever I go, whatever I do, please help me always remember that I'm representing you. Srila Prabhupada, I'm just representing you. And then immediately, all the stress, all the fear, all the pressure, it just fizzles out. It just goes away. Because you realize, look, if I'm just representing Krishna, right? Then, okay, if Krishna wants to make a fool out of me, then what's the problem? You know, who is he making a fool out of? You see what I mean? How will Krishna make a fool out of me? Because the point is, if I'm really representing Krishna, then Krishna doesn't want to make a fool out of himself. You see what I mean? Then he will always make sure that we do properly. Because we're his representative. So that's the confidence of a devotee. That was the confidence of Arjuna on the battlefield. That I'm representing Krishna. So no one can stop me. It's okay. Even if I get killed on the battlefield, it's fine. So in the day, we should take every few minutes, we can take a moment to remind ourselves at this point. Because even though we say, oh, I'm studying hard, I'm trying to focus, they've done studies that say that for the average person, their mind wanders, like, I forget what it is now. Their mind wanders from what they're doing every 3 minutes or something. The mind will go someplace and you think something other than what you're working on. Excellent. There you go. 76 seconds. Right? Every 76 seconds, the mind wanders. That's what? Less than 1.5 minutes. That is a fact for everyone. The question for a devotee is simply where it wanders. If you can get the mind to wander towards Krishna every 76 seconds, then all these pressures, such as peer pressure, won't be a problem. It's just a matter of reminding ourselves, look, I'm a devotee of Krishna. That's my ultimate loyalty. And my loyalty is not ultimately to my friends, to my family, to anyone. My ultimate loyalty is to Krishna. And I'm proud of that fact.
Thank you, Prabhuji.
Okay. Okay, there's so many hands. Prabhuji, you can go and then up in the front and then yourself.
Hare Krishna. Prabhuji, like you completed your PhD in just 21 years. So, matlab, that was not normal for everybody. So in that age, the concentration was ought to be more. So, but giving example of mine, when I try to study, my mind gets distracted. So means how to concentrate it only in one place.
Yeah, it's a good question. Arjun asked the same question of Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. He says, Chanchalam hi mana Krishna pramathi balavad dhidam. He says, the mind is always fickle and restless, so difficult to control. Vayo rivasu dushkaram, he says. It's more difficult than controlling the wind. And Krishna, you know his answer to Arjuna's complaint? He says, simply by abhyasa or practice. Abhyasa and vairagya, he says, renunciation. We can do it. Now, what does this mean? These are like grand terms, abhyasa, vairagya, practice and renunciation. These two things go together. One, we just keep working at it. Right? We just keep working at it. You will get better over time. There's no doubt. I mean, sometimes we feel, oh, I'm so bad at this, I'm not getting any better. But if you compare yourself from what you were, say, 2-3 years ago, I guarantee you've improved. Just by the practice fact that you're trying, you're practicing. But then the second thing you have to ask is, this is a personal question, is you look at yourself and you say, what is it that my mind wanders to when I get distracted? What is it that attracts me? It may be we think, oh, it's just random things. But it's never random things. The mind is always attracted to something. We have some attachment or desire in the heart, which it becomes distracted by. So we have to find that out and figure what that is and realize, okay, this is the problem, and try to work at that problem. Try to cultivate the detachment to make the mind peaceful from what that is. So just try that exercise. Try to see what, when your mind, make it, like you can make a little journal, keep notes. Oh, this is what my mind wandered to. This is what my mind wandered to. This is what my mind. And you'll see a pattern there, guaranteed. Right? Because the mind is attracted towards certain things. I'll tell you for an example. Right? For most of my university students, right, this may will not be the case with us because all of you are devotees. But for most of my university students, there's one primary cause of distraction in studies. Not a grand distraction, moment by moment. What is that cause of distraction? Girls. Or for girls, boys. The opposite sex. You will not believe that this is not just distraction in the sense that, oh, they're not so motivated, and they are very motivated. But doing anything, sitting in the classroom, looking at who's there, in front, behind, beside, what is he saying, what is she saying, right? Sitting in the library, who's coming, who's going, right? It's a constant, non-stop, at least I would say 50% or maybe 40% at least of their mental energy is gone in keeping track of the opposite sex. That much. And this is not an exaggeration. One time, when I first became a professor, I didn't have too much experience in this. And one student, she came to me and she said, "Professor, I'm having a hard time, a very difficult time. I'm going through some personal issues. And so I wasn't able to complete the essay, the term paper. Is there any way I can get extension for a week?" So she seemed genuine. I felt sympathy, I thought. I said, "Okay, that's okay. Huh? But you're having a difficult time in the course." She said, "Yeah, I'm going through a lot." And I said, "Is there anything I can help? You know, I thought maybe it's some academic problem or something like that." And she said, no. I said, "You're sure? Is there anything?" And she said, no, it's not. She said, I just broke up with my boyfriend, who had been my boyfriend for a long time. After 6 months, we broke up. Right? So you can imagine, right? She considered this a long-term relationship. It had been going for a full 6 months. Can you imagine? Being with a boy or girl for 6 months, long-term relationship, right? She imagined, if she considers that a long-term relationship, 6 months, then imagine what her short-term relationships are, right? How many times in the course of a school year she goes up and down like that, right? Now, this is a bad case scenario, right? It's not a rare scenario. Everyone, I can tell you, half the students in my class are going through this, right? So what ability do they have to focus on their studies? When you're going through that, and that kind of pain and breakup and this and that, and, or if they're not on the way down from a breakup like she was, then they're on the way up. And that's even worse, right? You're even more difficult to focus on anything, right? When you're the euphoria of getting attracted and attached to someone. Right? No, more than half your ability to focus on the studies is gone right there. Now we think, well, that's an extreme case scenario. Right? We're not like that. Of course we're not like that. We're devotees. Right? But still, the point is, there's always things in our mind to which the mind becomes attracted. It latches on. And it's either hankering or it's lamenting. If we want it, the mind keeps going there. And if we didn't get it, the mind keeps suffering and it keeps lamenting. So that's what Krishna means, abhyasa and vairagya. We have to practice and we have to find those things which are causing the distraction and getting rid of them. One very practical way to do this, to help your mind concentrate, is to chant. And if, when your mind you find is getting very distracted, take a few minutes break from your work. Yeah. Again, my younger brother, he's very good at this. I've seen him many times. He'll be studying for a while and the mind starts getting tired. Sometimes that's all it is. It's nothing major like we're discussing. Sometimes the mind just gets tired. You've been studying for like 3-4 hours or 5 hours or a long stretch and the mind is getting fatigued. And when it gets tired, it becomes restless. So I've seen him many times. He gets tired in his studies. It's been a while, right? And he'll just get up from his studies, he'll pick up his beads, and he'll chant one round. He'll walk back and forth, and he'll just chant one round. And that makes the mind so peaceful, it calms things down, it clears the head, it gives you mental energy again. It gives you rest again. So try that. If you feel that it's your lack of focus is due to fatigue, or you've just been studying too much, right, take a couple minutes when your mind is getting specially restless, and you're realizing my productivity level is going low. take a break and chant one round. Come back to it, you'll find yourself much sharper.
And Guruji, another major problem with me is that whenever I start, I like reading books. So whenever I start reading books, I forget all which is around me.
This is not a major problem at all. This is quite a good problem actually. You mean when you start reading books, you cannot stop,
sometimes
huh?
Sometimes it gets extreme, you know. My parents are also angry that why you every time keep reading books. And then when I realize that it already gets late. So.
Yeah. What books are these?
Novels.
Novels.
Story books.
Yeah. I had the same thing. When I used to read books, I used to enjoy reading a lot. That once you get absorbed in a book, it's difficult to put it down. Of course, these weren't novels, right? The point is, the quality you have, the attraction you have for reading is very good. But see if you can replace the novels with something else. Right? Even educational books that you have to, that are non-fiction books are better. Right? But ideal is that if you can read some, there's some really nice books out there, which are Krishna conscious in nature. Of course, Srila Prabhupada's books and Shastras are there also. But there's others also, very, very nice books that you can read just as a matter of interest. And you'll find there's as much enjoyment there. Reading novels is a little bit of an addiction. When you get started in it, you can't stop. It's like watching films and movies, same thing. It just, you don't feel like there's any taste, any rasa in life, you know, if you get in the habit of reading novels, looking forward to the next novel. But try putting a stop to it. Try putting it away for some time. Say, try spending a week without, 2 weeks without reading any materialistic novels or something. Okay, it's difficult in the beginning. It's like you go through withdrawal symptoms. Like someone gives up smoking, then the addiction is there, so the body is like, the mind is angry, asking for it. But once you get over it, you'll realize that you can actually feel a lot of happiness and keep the mind engaged without having to resort to novels, materialistic stories, films, movies. Most people have this problem with movies. They have to watch. Every once a week on whatever it is, Monday evening or something when the film shows up, they have to watch. So it's some kind of addiction. When we're addicted to it, when we do it, we think, oh, how can I survive without this? Right? I really, really need it. But it's guaranteed. You force yourself 2-3 weeks you do without it, and at the end of that, you won't even feel the desire, the need for it. As long as you resist the temptation to go back again. So see if you can avoid the novel part. Otherwise, the problem of not being able to stop reading, that's a very good problem. And that's not a major problem. That's actually a sign of You'll learn a lot, and it's a very good curiosity and everything. But try to replace the books, huh? If possible. Okay, the two in the front have had. Yes, you and then
you. Prabhupada, you said that whatever we do for Krishna, He does double for me.
Yeah.
So once, actually, it was Pushpa Abhishek. I had faith in Krishna.
Yeah.
And then the next day, it was my match test. I had faith in Krishna and attended the Pushpa Abhishek all day. So the next day I heavily suffered. What was the reason for that?
You what?
I heavily suffered on the test. What was the reason for that?
You heavily suffered?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Maybe Krishna was too busy in his Pushpa Abhishek. He forgot that. Maybe you served Krishna so nicely, he forgot. I can't answer that question for you. In the sense that that's something, a matter of your personal experience. All I can offer is my own experience. We have to find a balance. There's two things. One is that we have to trust in Krishna. And we have to hope that He'll cover the rest. But the other thing is that we also cannot jump into the well and hope Krishna to save us. You know what I mean? In other words, that we also have to do our responsibility, our duty. So the point is, it's a matter of striking a balance. It's a matter of striking a balance. My point is in relation to service. If you have a service that you need to do for Krishna, it is my conviction that Krishna will never penalize you or make something go wrong because you did some service that was necessary for Him. That was your commitment to Krishna. Okay. Now, if it is a matter of attending festivals and things like that, then you have to find a balance. Okay, how much am I doing this for my own pleasure? How much do I need to focus on my studies and do my duty? Right? That's a matter of balance. But if there's some service that you've committed to Krishna, that Krishna, every Sunday I'm going to do this seva for you. Krishna, every day I'm going to chant this many rounds. Right? For that, Krishna will never ever make you suffer. You see what I mean? Just if you spend the day, I don't know the details of your particular situation. Right? I'm speaking in general here. If we just, for example, spend the day in the temple, kirtan, prasad, everything, and nice. Right? That in itself is not a guarantee. Right? Because Krishna always also insists that we have to do our duty. We have to do what's necessary. We have to focus on our studies and everything. But my point is, when there's some kind of commitment we make to Krishna, right, you have made a commitment, you've told the devotees, every Sunday I will do this service for Krishna. And one particular weekend you are very, very busy. But you still come and you do that seva. You rush into the temple, you do your seva, and then you go back, or whatever. Or you bring your books with you. Then you'll find Krishna will never ever make you suffer for that. Okay? So it's a matter of commitment, what we commit to Krishna. That's the key. Because when we make a commitment to Krishna, then Krishna makes a commitment for us. That's the point. Okay? Is that?
Prabhuji, sometimes like we have to do exams in a day, and in the same day we have to do programs of our ISKCON. So how to manage that? We have a time management problem.
Yeah. These are exams that happen on a regular basis or like big exams?
Big exams.
Yeah. Then you should focus on the exams. You should focus on the exams. Means if it's a big exam and it's important to do, then you should do the exam. Right? And then you make up for it with Krishna next day. After the exams are over, you go to the temple, you spend the whole day doing service there. Krishna will appreciate it. My father. Huh? Yes. So he's saying, for the student, the duty is to study. Right? This is just like for Arjun, what did he do all day, all night? Right? He fought for Krishna. Right? But, mam anusmara yudhyacha, Krishna says. Think of me and fight. So, mam anusmara studicha. Think of me and study. That's the point.
Okay. Prabhuji, and our second problem which I am facing is sometimes we have our temple arranges yatra or some picnic we go of devotional places. But at the same time in classes we have exams. So, what to do? Like, it's a thing that we have never went to that place and we are eager to go there. But then, but the same day when we are going, that's the last exam of the class. What to do?
Right. Yeah, so it's a sacrifice, you know. It's sacrifices we have to make. Means, if you feel confident that you can do well on the exam and still go on the yatra, then you can go. Otherwise, okay, do the exam and find other opportunities to enjoy with the devotees. The key is, there's so many wonderful things happening in the devotee community. And we should make our friends devotees and we should associate with them. But more than that, each one of us should make a commitment to Krishna. And a commitment means what? A minimum number of rounds that we'll chant every day and some practical devotional service that we do at least on a weekly basis. That we should, each one of us should find something that we want to do in terms of, and we make a commitment to Shri Radha Gopinath that this is what I'm going to do for you. That you should not give up at all costs. Okay? And if you do that for Krishna, then Krishna will make sure that you get all the enjoyment you want in terms of the devotee association, the wonderful activities in the temple and everything that goes along with it. Okay? So in other words, in these matters you may have to sacrifice to focus on your studies. But that's not what we mean here by commitment to Krishna, by devotional service. That's all wonderful, it's good things. But by commitment here we mean you find some seva, some service that you're going to do on a regular basis, and some sadhana that you're going to do on a daily basis. That's what you have to find a commitment to. And everything else will follow.
Prabhuji, and my third and the major problem which I am facing is like, some subjects in our school studies we don't like it.
Right.
Or that is very boring subjects. So sometimes when we start studying it, we go to sleep.
Right.
So it affects our studies, what to do in that case.
Right. Okay. You know, Arjun on the battlefield, you think he enjoyed doing so many of the things he did? You think it was enjoyment for him to fight his grandfather, to shoot Bhishma Dev with arrows, to fight in battle? It was not enjoyment. Right? It was so difficult. He didn't like doing it. And therefore anyone, you know, would get tired and fall asleep. That's natural. But Arjun, his name was? Do you know what his name was regarding sleeping? Vudakesha. That he who had conquered sleep. So my point is, if you're tired, you should take rest. If you're tired, you should take rest. Sleeping is actually a very important activity at our age. Because the mind, it processes a lot of information while we're asleep. Especially if you're doing a lot of study work and your mind is constantly intellectually engaged, then it needs the rest that you get from sleeping properly. So if you're tired, if it's a result of tiredness, then you should take sleep. You should rest. But if you're just bored, then somehow just think, look, I have to do this for Krishna. This is my duty. I'm doing a sacrifice for Krishna. So somehow I have to just grit my teeth and get through it. And it's like drinking bitter medicine. It's not comfortable, but we have to do it. Okay, I just want to ask here, are there any questions from the girls? Because so many of the boys have been asking questions. I want to give you an opportunity also, if you have questions. Any questions from this side? Say that again?
They want to do something which is good, devotional, but because they're friends, devotee friends, you know, they are not doing. They have to do it alone. For example, homeschooling. You know, they want to do it, but they insist, no, only if my friends do, then I will do it.
Right.
So how did you handle this, that you are, you know, homeschooled, only you and your brother, hardly any friends studying with you? So was it boring, your life was boring, or was it exciting, or is it simply a force by your parents to go through what they wanted you to go through?
Yeah, no, it was not boring. It was always full of excitement, because the nature of a Krishna conscious lifestyle is that it's full of excitement. The way the excitement comes is always by engaging, participating in preaching activities. That's where the real excitement is. And for us, our whole life was full of the temple. It means homeschooling was one part of the overall experience of life in the temple. Constantly going on preaching, serving the deities, Sunday programs, lecturing, doing so many different activities that made for a very, very dynamic lifestyle. Just study is very boring. Right? This is, a human being is not meant to just study all the time. Unfortunately, our world, our civilization is such that we have to study so much constantly. That's okay. But life, to be full, has to have a lot more to it. And preaching activities, associating with devotees, this is what really is gives spice to life. You know, that's wonderful. Yes, Prabhu. Actually, the devotee there, the smaller one here. Sorry.
Prabhuji, the temptation is one of the most distracts me, especially television. So what to do in this?
Yeah. Good question. Good question. Very good question. Television is the greatest temptation in the world today. Television is Maya's most effective tool to capture us in Kali Yuga. Right? Practically, the TV is the incarnation of Maya Devi in Kali Yuga. Right? It's her incarnation. Haridas Thakur, you know his story? She came in the form of a beautiful woman. In Kali Yuga, she doesn't have to do that. Right? She comes in the form of the television. And Mother Urmila, she disciples Srila Prabhupada, she calls the television the one-eyed guru. It sits there and we all sit in front of it. And we take whatever the television says as instruction. It's addictive. Through the TV, Maya brings every aspect of Kali Yuga. Meat eating, illicit sex, gambling, intoxication. It brings it, she brings it right into our homes, into our bedrooms. And that's the power of the television. That before, in order to commit sinful activities, you had to go out somewhere. Right? if one wanted to see men and women behaving illicitly, not dressed properly, you'd have to go to a bad section of town, right, to see it. You'd have to actually go there, take a risk of your reputation and what someone will see and like that, to go see something like that, something bad. Today, you don't have to do that. All you have to do is turn on the TV or turn on the internet. She brings all of Maya right into our homes and programs us like that. So with TV, it's something like reading novels also. Right? We should turn it off. Turn off the TV, unplug and cut the cord. Right? And it's difficult in the beginning. It's difficult. But again, try going 1 week without TV. At the end of the week, see how you feel. See how you feel. And if you feel okay, if you survive that 1 week, okay? If you're still alive at the end of that 1 week, then try one more week after that and see how it goes. You'll see there's so much more to do in life than that. Huh? If you give up TV, you can accomplish so much more. There's so many exciting things you can do. You'll have more time for your friends. You'll have more time to do interesting activities. You can come to the temple. You can go touring. You can go on vacations, holidays. So many things are there. Television saps up so much of our time, you know. We think, I'm only watching for 15 minutes. We end up watching for 1 hour. So again, try turning it off and see what happens. It's not that bad. In the beginning it's difficult, but you'll get used to it. I hardly ever watched television growing up, except when we went to some friend's place and they had it on. Right? Practically no television. And life is good. Life is okay. Yeah. Michael. It's on. Just a suggestion to all of you, when you receive the mic and you finish speaking, don't turn it off. Just hand it to the next person because it creates confusion.
I did read the last year one teacher and about 50 students committed themselves not to watch TV for 1 week.
Where was this?
Somewhere in the U.S. So I'm saying even they are trying to do this because the technology, everything is coming from there and they are tired of it. And they're starting to see the bad effects of that.
Yeah.
And they succeeded. Yeah. And but then after 1 week was over,
and they watched double. Yeah. So for us it should be even easier because we've got a good alternative. Right? They don't have anything to replace it with, but we do. So many benefits are there. You also save the environment by using less electricity. You turn it off for a week. Yes, there. Oh, okay, you go ahead and then behind you again after that.
Prabhuji, you told about this TV. Prabhuji, but there are some movies for children like Charlie Chaplin and Tom and Jerry and all those things. Prabhuji, so can we see that thing, Cartoon Network?
Yeah. Yeah. If you can, watch Krishna conscious films, right? If you can. But don't watch anything on television. If you really, really want to watch some kind of films that are good for children or interesting to you, get the film itself and watch the film, but don't turn on the television. Because the point is that TV is endless. You see, that's the problem. It means, okay, you might get addicted to videos and buy 3 every day, right? Or rent 3 every day and watch nonstop. That, of course, is also addictive. But the point is, television, there's no end. Once you have the TV on, there's, number one, there's no end, there's no limit to it. Number two, you have no control over what you're getting. You don't know. This program might be good. 5 minutes later, a very bad program might be there. Right? So, by all means, turn off the television. And if you have to, watch it in DVD or video. Right? And gradually, wean yourself off of that also. Life is really, really exciting for a devotee. Really, there are so many. When you get a higher taste, then the lower taste, they don't feel that bad. It's just a matter of gradually getting us off. Okay, behind you, he had his hand up there.
If a friend asks to do something, but then you feel that I should do for him or else he'll feel bad and all. So if some Krishna conscious lecture is going on and the other friend is interested in playing, so what the, that time we can do it.
And you feel that the friend will feel bad, right, if you don't play with him. Yeah. So that then we have to ask the question, well, does it mean to be a true friend? What does it mean to be a real friend? At going out and playing with a friend, are you actually being a good friend? Are you actually benefiting him? Just like if, for example, suppose a child doesn't want to go to school, right? Suppose you don't want to go to school. And your parents say, oh, it's okay, you don't want to go to school, why don't you just play all day? They're being really nice to you, right? Are they being your real friend? No. Why? Because they're letting you play now, but later on, 10 years down the road, you're going to curse them. That why they didn't give me an education, now I'm going to suffer my whole life, right? So the point is, we have to ask, what does it mean to be a real friend? Your friend is going to ask you out to play. If you go out to play with him, are you really being his friend? No, you're not being his friend. You're doing a disservice to him, and especially you're doing a disservice to yourself, right? By preventing your own Krishna consciousness. So we can explain to him, it's okay, I'll come and play with you, let me just finish this class, and then I'll come and play with you. Okay. Yeah. There are multiple hands. Who hasn't asked a question yet? I want to give them first opportunity, if you haven't. Okay, over there, yeah. Mataji?
If I'm invited to a non-devotee's house, how do I refuse the food over there without she feeling bad? Because that food is not offered to Krishna.
Yeah. Okay. It's a good question. Very good question. It can be difficult in social circumstances. Prabhupada said that if we're going to someone's house to perform kirtan for the purpose of a preaching program, then we can, and the food is cooked purely, we can take that food, offer it to Krishna and eat it. But if we're going purely for a social occasion, and that food is not offered to Krishna, then we should encourage our friends, our hosts, to come up to that standard. We have to explain to them that this is what my standard is. Okay? It's nothing about you personally. It's nothing about you. This is just my standard. It's my personal, it's like my vrat. You know, in India, people are commonly, they keep different vrats. On Monday, they do a vrat for this, and Tuesday for Hanumanji, and Saturday they have a vrat for this, and you know, and sometimes ladies do this Karva Chauth vrat, and people have all kinds of vrats going. And so you just explain, this is kind of like my vrat. Okay, I only eat food which is free of onions and garlic, meat, fish or eggs, and that is offered to Krishna. Now, the point is, sometimes people can get a little offended, but if they see that you are consistent in your practice, not that you're eating at one friend's place and not eating at another one. Sometimes you eat and sometimes you don't. Then people get offended. But if you're consistent, say, I've made this decision, I practice this everywhere, then people don't feel so offended. They don't feel so offended. Now, if they're cooking purely without onions and garlic, right, and obviously without meat, fish or eggs like that, then you can ask them, is it okay if I offer this to Krishna? Offer it with them and then you can take it as prasad. Right? So in this way you help them in the offering process also. To a picture of Krishna?
Yeah.
They have any pictures? Then most Indian homes have some devotional picture. Or if you don't have anything, you can offer in your own mind. Right? You can offer it to the Lord. Like that. But it's nice if you do it with your host, with your friend. So you kind of make the point to them that, look, I only eat Krishna Prasad, since this is cooked without any things that Krishna does not eat, so I can offer it now, and then we can take it. Yes.
This question has come up so many times, and not only with all of you, but even with the adults. And our personal experience is that if you show the integrity,
right,
You know, if you refuse a couple times nicely, then you know what happens? They become challenged. So now I got to get them to eat in my house. So let me see what I can do. So in Boise, there are people who had gone out of the way to buy new pots, steel pots. So he said, no aluminum. The pots should have been pure, no eggs in it, so on and so forth. They go and buy the pots. And they literally plead with us. Please come eat once. But first you have to show the integrity. So, you know, that's, it's like, there's so many ways to attract a boyfriend or girlfriend. Now you don't have that. But one then is when you constantly refuse, then he or she, oh, you know, there's something about him. I gotta get him, right? Have you experienced that? The more you say no, the more somebody wants to say yes. So that's what you have to do is first, even at my own work, person says, no, you can have it. I said, no. And then first they feel offended, but then I've seen after about third time, even without my saying it, they said, Arun, please come. We already have a salad for you. They always, the secretary at the workplace, she knew exactly what to order for me. So anytime there was a business lunch, she said, Arun, I've taken care of you. See, I didn't even have to say anything. So I'm saying, you have to show the integrity. You have to show that you mean what you say. What happens is, you say no, and then you see the cake, sab chalta, aaj kha leta. Chalna bazaar nahi hai. Then you have to say no. So you see what I'm saying? Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No. That's a good point. People really value consistency. If right from the start we give a single message, then people, they respect us for that. Ultimately, the respect will develop. And some may not respect ever. They're offended forever. But then we have to ask, okay, then are they really our friends? You know what I mean? Are these the people we want to associate with? If they cannot respect my spiritual decision at all. But like my father saying, we cannot be hypocrites in that regard. We have to be consistent that this is my decision. Okay, in the green shirt, Proji, you've had your hand up for a while. And then next to you.
Prabhuji, if you compare a life of a materialistic person, like a normal person who does his business and everything, and if you compare it to a life of a Vaishnava, you always find that a life of a Vaishnava is always so calm, peaceful. Means he's totally has control of his mind, while the person who does his business, and is like a normal person, he doesn't have any control. He always has stress, tension. So what would be the cure for that person, like to lessen his stress or to make him
to get connected with Krishna?
Yes.
Right? As much as possible. Means that it's the process of devotional service that gives peace to the mind, that makes the mind calm. This is, Krishna says this in Bhagavad Gita. He says, Bhoktaram yajna tapasam sarva loka maheshwaram suhidam sarva bhutanam yajnyatva shantim vichyati. He who knows me as the Supreme Lord, as the controller of everything, that person attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. Right? So, in other words, we can help that person by connecting them with Krishna in some way. The beginning is always with prasadam. And if we bring a little bit of prasadam to them and ask them to eat, just eating prasadam causes such a change in heart that the mind becomes peaceful. You'll see, like, directly the effect of that prasad. And we've seen it over and over again. You can give the hardest person some prasad, and if they eat it, they're literally in front of your eyes, they feel relief and their heart is changed. And then prasadam leads to some connection with devotees, to chanting the holy name. Perhaps it's just through a book that you might give them. But somehow getting them connected to Krishna, by hook or by crook, somehow or other, it'll give them relief. That's the best way to help them.
Thank you, Babaji.
Nice question. Next to you, behind you. Yes, sir. Behind you. Yeah.
Hare Krishna, Babaji.
Hare Krishna.
When I entered in the temple, I feel very, I feel okay, but when I enter here, all the devotees were in sadras, and I came first time in this temple that my mom said go and attend the lecture. So I feel very awkward that all are in sadras and having japmas, but...
So sadras means groups, you mean?
Kurta.
Kurtas.
So, and the question is that I am a non-vegetarian. It's okay that I also do chanting 2 times a day, but it's okay that I am a non-vegetarian. When my friend comes at home, I go at my friend's home. We share we have non-veg dishes or at parties, we have non-veg dishes. That I want to ask you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I come first.
Yeah. In terms of your first question, don't worry about the dress, okay? Don't worry about the dress. Dress is something only external. It has an effect on our consciousness. This is why we wear a particular dress. It means the way you dress has an effect on what's inside. Just like if you dress, suppose you're going for some kind of interview, right? For a school interview or a job interview or something. Then you always go in your best dress, right? When you go to school, you wear a uniform, right? Why? Because it creates a certain, you feel more confident, right? If you go in your best dress. And it creates a certain mood and atmosphere, a sense of friendship, right, of the group. So we wear this particular Vaishnav dress because it helps create that proper attitude in the mind. That yes, I am a representative of Krishna. You cannot forget that when you wear this dress because you're looking like that. So it helps create that right consciousness in the mind. But ultimately, that is not the important thing. Right? The important thing is to begin the process of Krishna consciousness. So don't worry about the dress. There's many people here who are dressed simply in pant and shirt. That's okay. The main thing is to somehow engage ourselves in Krishna consciousness. And one of the nice things to start with that is, like you said, chanting. Chanting is an excellent way. And if you can chant Hare Krishna every day, you can do one round every day. Are you doing that? Two rounds every day. Very good. So if you can continue that, that's excellent beginning on the process of Krishna consciousness. Then the next step is to give up non-vegetarian food. Because if there's one thing that makes the hard heart, makes the heart hard, right, and it destroys our ability to feel compassion.
From childhood, I have done that from non-veg.
Yeah, that's okay. I mean, see, the Krishna consciousness movement is present all over the world. So many devotees are there, American devotees, European devotees. And if we think we've eaten non-veg from the beginning, you should see what these people have done from the beginning. Right? Their whole diet is based on beef. Right? From the time they're babies, they're fed this food. And they're able to give it up through the process of Krishna consciousness. Means that we've done it, yes, this becomes our habit, yes. But just the fact that we've done something doesn't mean that it's necessarily good. Meat eating is one of those things that we could talk a long time about. Doctors all over the world agree that meat is very harmful for your health. People die of heart disease and cancer as a result of meat eating. It's bad for your health. It's bad for the environment. It's ethically wrong because animals, even if you don't believe animals have souls, but animals feel pain just like everyone else. If you cut the throat of an animal, you see it yelling and screaming and you see the blood flowing. It's no different than a human being. And just like we won't eat a human being, why should we eat an animal? And it's ethically wrong, and ultimately it's spiritually wrong. Because we can never offer food that is non-vegetarian. Krishna will never accept it. There's a famous American poet. His name was George Bernard Shaw. And he said, we go to church every day, and we pray for light on the path we tread. And yet, day by day, we gorge ourselves upon the dead. We go to church and we pray for light on the path we tread, and yet every day we gorge ourselves upon the dead. Means on one hand, we come to God and we say, please help me, give me your mercy. Bhagavan kripa karo. And on the other hand, we're eating His own children. So, Krishna, He doesn't appreciate that. He doesn't appreciate that. So, try. See if you can do it. That's kind of the next step. Chant Hare Krishna and try to give up meat eating. Okay? Yeah. Thank you for that. Very, very nice. Good question. On your first visit to ask such an honest and direct question. Okay, one question here from the lady side. And then the boys up here in the front. They've been waiting for a while.
Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna.
Thank you for the nice lecture. I wanted to ask that some friends, they are addicted to cell phones and all the other electronic gadgets. So our friends have it, but we too feel that we should also have that. But our parents, they refuse to buy. So what do we do?
They refuse to buy cell phones. For you? Yeah, that's actually very, very, you're very fortunate, very lucky. you know, this whole world is, people call it a connected world. We're all connected, right? Connectivity. This is the big thing these days. Everyone's connected. You have cell phones, you can talk to anyone, anywhere. You have text messaging, SMS, right? And you can send text messages to anyone, anywhere. You have emails, letters get there just like this. Social networking sites, you have them here also? In America, the big one is Facebook. Facebook and MySpace. Do you do that here? Yeah? Or there are some big other Indian ones? I've gotten invitations from my cousins and stuff to join like Yari or something like that. These social networking sites. And people feel, I'm connected. Right? We're all so connected. We've got so many friends and everything. You know, the only thing that these technologies do is that they disconnect us. They make us more distant from each other. People have forgotten how to maintain a face-to-face conversation. If you talk to someone for 2 minutes, and in that 2 minutes, they can't figure out what to say, right? There's an awkward moment. Immediately, you watch two people like that. They both pull out their cell phones and start playing with them, right? Or start calling someone. Two people will be walking down the street. Obviously, there are two friends going out for the evening. They're walking down the street, going to spend time together. And one is on the cell phone talking to someone there, and one is on the cell phone talking to someone there. What are they talking about? Oh, when will we meet? Yeah, let's meet up here. And when they actually meet, what do? They pick up their cell phones and talk to someone else. This world has become so impersonal. You know, places like Facebook and these social networking sites, they're so isolating. They're so isolating. There's been many cases in the United States of children who've committed suicide because they were insulted on these social networking sites. And the people who insulted them or who spread bad rumors about them on these websites, they don't even know who they are. They've never seen their face. And yet they're so affected by it. This technology makes us more and more lonely. We become separated from people. Because we become afraid of human contact. We became afraid of human contact. My students, they, many of them, they do not know how to maintain a conversation with a stranger. Suppose you sit down next to someone and you don't know that person. Then what are you expected to do? Now make small talk, right? Chit-chat. How are you? I'm such and such. And what's your name? And how are things going? And like that. And oh, interesting. And you pick up something and one thing leads to another and another thing. And you end up making friends out of that person. These students cannot maintain a conversation with a stranger. They don't know how to do it. And I'm telling you, I've seen many Indian students the same way. Many Indian students. They come to the United States, they're software programmers and engineers, and they have no social skills whatsoever. They've spent their whole lives in front of computers. Their entire social life is with email or with cell phones. And when a human being comes to them, they meet a human being, they don't know how to deal with him. And how do we deal with a human being? So these technologies are there, cell phone and so forth. But we have to remember they are only a tool. Purely, strictly a tool. Just like a hammer is a tool. Right? How many of you... Okay, hammers are very important. They're necessary. To hammer in nails to build something. And sometimes you need a hammer. How many of you would think about carrying a hammer with you all the time? And everywhere you go. It's a tool. I need it. A hammer. And it's measuring tape and scissors and everything. No. Unless you're a construction worker, you don't need a hammer. Somehow with cell phones, we think, I need my cell phone constantly. It's like becomes an attachment on the hand. It parts of my body, you know. I have to have it. And people start fiddling with it compulsively. It's strictly a tool. That's all it is. If you need it for your job, if you need it for your work, if you need it for safety's sake, right, then keep it with you. But only because it's a tool. It's not a means of entertainment. And it's even not a means of communication. Communication happens face to face with real human beings. So if we see it as a tool, it's okay. That's all. For ourselves, in our whole family, no one has a cell phone. Only we come to India, we keep a cell phone. Because while traveling, it sometimes becomes useful in terms of when you're in an unfamiliar place. So it functions as a tool. In the United States, we don't need it. We don't have a cell phone. I've never kept a cell phone my whole life. Now, some of my friends, they're doctors. They need to be on call when the patient calls. So they need a cell phone. Okay? But then it becomes a tool. Not that this becomes a source of our rasa, our juice in life, is our cell phone. You see what I mean? Yeah. It's an addiction of this age. So many addictions are there. We've talked about novels. We've talked about television. Cell phones are another good example of that. Okay. Have you asked a question before? Yeah? Okay. So he's first time. Everyone should get an opportunity for at least one question.
Prabhuji, sometimes there are late night programs and the tomorrow's school is affected. So how should we do it?
Yeah. That's difficult. Yeah, sleep is very important. Like I said, if you're studying a lot, it's important to get enough sleep. So maybe you can leave the program a little bit early. Is that possible? And go home and get to rest a little bit early. Right? If the next day you don't have anything important going on, you can stay late. You can stay late and participate in the full thing. Especially if it's a weekend. Maybe late night programs you can do on the weekend when the next day is less. But otherwise, student life is brahmacharya life. Right? Brahmacharya life. And brahmacharya life means early to bed and early to rise. Right?
Yes. Yeah. So would you like, in our school, suppose we are toppers of our class. So someone may get envious and they may hide some of our books in our exam so that we go down. What to do in that case?
You don't let them do that, okay? Complain to teachers, complain to your parents, complain to someone who can do something, and you have to be firm and forceful. And but devotees are not cowards. You don't let them do that to you.
But if we don't know who is doing that, and suppose if he is doing that in our research time, so what to do?
Is there no one you can go to for help? No?
How?
I don't know the school system here, but is there some principal, some teacher,
yes,
some older boys you could go to for help? Right?
Yes,
someone?
But until and unless we don't know who is doing that, how can we go?
No, so the point is we should do something about it. Right? Prabhupada said devotees are not cowards. They're not cowards. We tolerate. If something goes wrong, we tolerate. We don't become revengeful. That's not the point. We don't become revengeful. But if something is a problem, then we try to stop it. We try to figure it out. Okay? We don't let that happen. I remember one time in university, I was in a math class, and the professor was grading on a curve. You know, grading on a curve means the highest grades are determined by those who perform the best. So it means if only 30 or 40 is the highest grade that people are getting, then that becomes the A category. That becomes top marks. So everything is based on what the performance is in class. So I was getting very high marks in that class. And so what would happen is because of my high marks, everyone else's marks was going lower. And so a couple of students, they went out in the hall and they figured out who I was. And they're really upset at me. They got angry. So I just spoke very clearly to them. Okay, it's not my problem. You go speak to the professor. It's the professor who's instituted this system of grading. I'm going to do my best. Are you doing your best? Or are you lazing off? And he said, no, I'm doing my best. I said, then fine. I'm doing my best. You do your best. But point is, we don't have to back down. Right? We don't have to be weak. That's not what devotees are. We're always respectful. We're always tolerant. We're never revengeful, but it doesn't mean we have to be weak. Okay? So see if there's something you can do about it. Or if you're just asking for someone else, then you can advise them to try to help you. This devotee here, he's been had his hand on for a while.
I have been attending social programs of my relatives. They always cheat me of eating onion and garlic. They mash the onions and mix that in the vegetables, and they say, oh no, this doesn't have onion or garlic. So what should I do for that?
Means you're going with your parents or you're going alone?
Parents.
with parents, and the parents are experiencing the same thing.
Yeah.
Your parents are devotees?
No.
They're not devotees. Okay. So, it can be a difficult situation. The onions and garlic you can smell in the food fairly quickly, right?
Yeah.
So, that means they cannot actually hide it from you. Right? So, when you smell it, are you in a situation where you can tell them, I'm sorry, there's onions or garlic in here, I cannot eat it. Can you tell them like that? But means your parents cook for you without onions and garlic. Yeah?
Yeah. My mother cooks that, but my whole family says don't cook it. See how long he will stay hungry without that.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So, maybe you can show your determination to them. I think if you show your determination once, they won't try it again, second time. This was Gandhiji's policy. Right? Gandhiji's policy. Okay, do what you have to. If I have to starve, I'll starve. Right? So you just have to see the situation. This is a touchy issue because you're dealing with relatives. It's not just friends. Right? So, but if you can, if they're cheating you, then you just show your determination, because that's not a nice thing. It means they should argue with you, they should try to insist, they can order you, they can try to convince you, but trying to cheat you is not good. Trying to hide it and stick it in your food, that's not nice. That's not gentlemanly behavior. Right? If they disagree, then they can try to force you. No, eat it, you should eat it. Yeah? But try to hide it and slip it in your food, what will that do? You see what I mean? So you can just, if once you know it's there, then you just, you refuse. You say, I'm not going to. My grandfather once gave this example. He went to study in to do a degree in physics in London, in England. And he had a pact with his friends that no one would try to make him eat meat. At that time, vegetarianism was practically unknown. No one was vegetarian. Today, the UK is full of vegetarians, but at that time, no one was vegetarian. And he said, I can always tell where there's meat, I won't touch it. And sometimes students, his friends would try to slip it in, into the food. They'd mash it up and put it inside. And he refused. He got very angry with them. He said, no way, I'll go hungry, I'll starve, but I won't eat that. And so the point is, sometimes if people are being dishonest, then we have to show our determination. Because that's not nice. That's not proper.
Thank you.
And you, at least you have your parents for your support.
Nowadays, internet has become a big question.
We
use internet for our everyday life, school, at least in the school projects. And with the internet, there's a lot of unwanted stuff, which tempts us to do something which is unwanted. So, what's your
opinion? Yeah. The internet is, again, it's the same thing like this television, only worse. More than 90% of all the content that's on the internet is pornography or things with heavy violence in it. More than 90% of everything that's there. The internet is just like a big dump, you know, it's like a big toilet. For all the worst things about human beings are there on the internet. Because you can see anything, you can say anything, and no one has a clue who's saying it and what's being said. No clue whatsoever. You can do anything on the internet. No one will know who did it. Right? They can do some investigation, this and that, but 99% of the time, no one can trace it. So it becomes a complete cover for demons to do whatever they like and not get caught. Right? Again, it's an excellent tool for Kali Yuga, for Maya. And that's why we have to be very, very careful and use it only as a tool. Right? Use it only as a tool. One of the practical things you can do is the internet, the computer that uses the internet, put it in a public area. Like, put it in the middle of your drawing room or something. Or put it right next to the kitchen. Some place where everyone can see it walking past. Not in a corner somewhere, behind a shelf or something. Right, on your desk. No, put it in some open space. That way everyone can use it, and everyone knows that other people are watching. Right, so it helps. Because we're all weak, right? Temptation is part of all of us. There's no one who can stand up and say, oh, I'm completely free of temptation. No, temptation is there in everyone. The key is that somehow we should not be depressed by that fact. The key is somehow to control ourselves, to help prevent ourselves from doing that. Just like Srila Prabhupada, sometimes someone asked him, he was talking about his own childhood. And he said, oh, the same attraction was there between boys and girls that is there now. Same attraction was there. The only difference is that we never acted upon that attraction. Why? Because the society was built in such a way that you could not. You were protected. So we have to do the same thing with the internet. Right? Use it as a tool. You can install certain kinds of filters that prevent bad material from coming in. And the most important thing is to always do it in a place where you have association. Never do it alone. Okay? Never do it alone. For brahmacharis, no female association, they say. Female association and email association, both are very, very close, almost the same. You can have plenty of female association through email association and no one will know. It's the same thing. You take a boy and girl, sit down in a private room somewhere, no one knows. Doing it on, talking to a girl on email, same thing. No difference. It's a private space, right? It's a virtual space. So we have to be very, very careful. For brahmacharis especially, we're all aspiring brahmacharis. Right? Student life means brahmacharya. It means we're celibate. We're focused on just service to the spiritual master and our studies. Right? So we have to be very careful of this email association. Okay, new person there.
You were just talking about association. So you know a good friend and you want him to become a devotee. So you give more hours on just preaching him. But then your consciousness changes. So what should we do about it?
Your consciousness changes as a result of associating with them. Yeah, that's a good question. Very good question. And a very frequent problem also. Naturally, when we become devotees, we become introduced to Krishna consciousness. The happiness of Krishna consciousness is so great that we automatically want to involve those who we are closest with. That usually means our relatives and our friends. And so people often go to try to preach to their relatives or to their friends. And as a result, become sucked in by that atmosphere and become weak in their own spiritual life. So we have to be very careful. We should only preach to the extent that we can maintain our own spiritual life properly. In other words, you can go preach to someone out here for an hour, no problem. But when you know that you have a weak spot somewhere, a weak point, then you should be very careful. Means there are ways of helping someone become a devotee that don't necessarily involve close connection, so much close association. Also, bring your friend to the temple, give him some prasad on a regular basis. Encourage him to read books, like that. But if you find that as a result of that, your own spiritual life is becoming weak, then maybe you have to reduce the association a little bit. Because the point is, unless we can save ourselves, we cannot save anyone else. When you're throwing a rope to someone, this is what preaching is. Suppose someone is in the middle of a river, drowning, and you throw a rope. If you yourself don't have your feet on firm ground, and that person is pulling, then what's going to happen? All of us, we have our feet on ground, but we're still halfway in the water. We're not out on the shore. So, Prabhupada, he's thrown us a rope. Prabhupada, he's got his feet firmly planted on the banks. He's come to the edge of the river to throw the rope. We've gotten the rope by his mercy. So, our feet are fairly steady. We're engaged in some form of regulated devotional practice, Vaidhi Bhakti. The feet are on the ground. But we're still in the water, up to our waist. Some of us to our necks. Right? So, if we throw the rope to someone else, it's good. But if that someone else is strong enough to pull us off our feet and back into the water, then we know we have to be careful. That we have to be careful. So, one nice thing in that way is to perhaps connect that friend with the association of another devotee who can help him. Because sometimes we become weak with those who are closest to us. So, bring that friend with you and talk to that friend, preach to them in the association of someone else. Have another devotee friend sit with you to talk to him. Right? Or introduce that friend to another devotee and ask them to take prasad together. That sometimes helps. And that's sometimes more effective also. Friends and relatives often don't listen to people who are their closest to. And if you try preaching to a close relative, they say, I know you too well, you're just saying these things. But sometimes they hear it from someone else, it makes more sense. So, protect yourself first, that's the key.
The second question was, we do something with good intention, but people take it the other way. So, how should we cope up with this?
we do something with good intention and people take it the wrong way.
Like we bring our friends to temple, but there are 2-3 devotees, they are just looking at you, staring at you, what you are doing.
Yeah.
How should we go?
Yeah. People misjudge our intentions a lot. This is the nature of the material world. We were discussing this yesterday, that because no one really knows our heart, right? So people sometimes mistake what our intention is. Right? And in that case, it's okay. It's okay. The rule is that a devotee should try to be as humble as possible. Humility. Okay, someone is misunderstanding me. That's okay. They're not doing it with any bad motivation, any ulterior motivation, any malicious intent. Right? So maybe you can speak to that devotee and clear it up with them. That's usually the nicest thing, is just to go very humbly and open up some communication. That, Prabhuji, I'm doing this, perhaps were you, is this okay? You think this is okay? I brought a couple friends. Huh? Generally, devotees are quite happy to see you bring friends with you to the temple. But if you feel there's some, in any point, there's some misunderstanding, then the best thing is to immediately not let it fester in the mind. Don't let you start wondering, oh, I wonder what that devotee is thinking. And the devotee starts wondering, I wonder what he's thinking. Next time you see it even gets worse and you think, oh, I saw him again. This time again he didn't smile at me. And the devotee thinks, yeah, again he didn't smile at me. And it gets worse and worse. And pretty soon, in 1 month's time, you're full out enemies. Right? And no one can remember what started it. How the whole thing began. The mind has a way of building things up like this. Hindi mein kehte khichdi pakti. We make our own khichdis in our mind and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So the best thing is immediately, if you feel something, then open up the communication. And the nicest way, if you're dealing with a devotee, the nicest way is to come in a mood of service and say, Prabhuji, I'm doing this, is this okay? Is there anything I can do to serve you? And we come in the mood of service, it melts anyone's heart. It melts anyone's heart. So open up that communication as quickly as possible. And then usually, most situations, it's nothing. It's something very, very minor. If it is something, it's something so small, and the devotee tells you, Prabhuji, when you came in, you shouldn't behave like this. And you say, oh, okay, I didn't realize. Okay, but it's finished. And that satisfies both sides, and it's over. We shouldn't let it fester in the heart. That makes misunderstandings worse. Okay. One question there in the back there. Just 1 minute, huh? Let's get the mic first.
Roji, when we go to school, the teacher doesn't allow us to wear kantimala, so what we should do?
Oh. Is that the general case here? Teachers don't allow kantimala? Oh, they don't allow, huh? Acha, acha, acha. Right. Are there any class members who are sympathetic? Yeah. And with the kantimala, if you explain to the teacher its religious significance even then, that it's not a fashion item and it's not... Acha, acha. So therefore they don't allow. You've tried speaking to the teachers and the principals, they refuse, huh?
See, so far this has never been a problem because it's hiding.
Acha. Okay. Okay. Because people should understand if you explain it that it's a religious significance, it has nothing to do with flouting the uniform, it has nothing to do with fashion or anything like that, and it's something very sacred we have to hold closely, right? Then people should be able to understand. If for some reason you're getting absolutely no concessions from the teachers or the principal or anyone, then what he can do is maybe get a larger kantimala and wear it a little bit lower. Right? Maybe instead of 3 rounds or 2 rounds, you can do 1 round and wear it in such a way that it falls across the chest. That way, at least Tulsi is always there. Right? It's touching. And then when he comes to the temple, he can hold it up higher. Right? Okay, but otherwise you can hold, you can wear it lower. Same thing with tilaka. If it's big problem, then we can apply water tilak in the morning, right? And chant. The idea is you should chant all the mantras for protection on the various parts of the body. Even if it's just water, then you Om Keshavaya Namah, Narayana Namah, Madhavaya Namah, Govindan. And in this way, the entire body becomes purified, and Krishna protects all the different limbs of our body. Right? So all these things are important. We can see how much you can push. If the seniors and the teachers and so forth, they agree to it, it's nice. If they don't, then maybe you can adjust like that. Right. Yeah, it seems very, very unfortunate that in India that would happen, you know? It's very... Right. Right. Okay, Prabhuji, yes, please.
Yeah, please. Prabhu, I've been tracking you since 15 years, probably now, I've known you. And I must say, in you I see a beautiful leader, a person who will take us, you know, the next level within ISKCON. I deeply appreciate your balance, the replies, and I think all this respect goes to mother and father as well. I have a question, I would want some good solid reasons so that these people also can understand. It's about language. Peer pressure makes you use certain foul language. So how did you overcome that? How do you want all of these people to realize what foul language means? How to overcome that? What are the benefits? So give me and all of us around here some good solid reasoning, some good solid experience. When you realized it, how you overcame it, or probably you didn't have to overcome it, you know, but how others can. So help us with that.
Thank you for your question. Thank you for your kind words also. In terms of foul language, I can answer in two different ways, materially and spiritually speaking. From a material perspective, sometimes it can seem very cool and very in with the times and with your friends, with peer pressure, or foul language is the way everyone talks. And they use these bad words and so forth. And to try to fit in and to try to speak like everyone, we start using it. But the fact of the matter is that anywhere you go in life and anything you try to accomplish, foul language is always looked upon as a sign of an uncivilized and low-class person. This is a fact everywhere in the world. Right? Everywhere in the world. The type of language you use is a marker of your level of intelligence, of your level of sophistication, of your ability. Right? In England, for example, those who speak the Queen's English, they immediately garner a sense of respect. Right? And those who speak with an Cockney accent and use all kinds of language, and they don't get that same kind of respect. Right? So, materially speaking, there's never a situation where less than gentlemanly language will somehow get you better marks or will somehow help you improve. In fact, it's always the opposite. Right? It always drags the person down. It always brings the person down, and you lose respect as a result. You might think you're gaining respect amongst your friends, but you actually lose respect quite heavily. Spiritually speaking, by using foul language, we pollute ourselves. We pollute our mouths. We pollute our minds. The mouth, we know, is an especially important place to keep always pure. We try to keep the mouth pure in two ways. How? Through Krishna Prasad and through Kirtan. Right? So, by using foul language, right, we completely pollute all those things. Right? And it becomes a place where Krishna cannot live. Right? Krishna cannot be inhabited. So it destroys the consciousness and it makes us unsuitable for chanting or for doing any other activities. Right? The mind immediately becomes dragged down. So both materially and spiritually, using foul language, there's no advantage to it whatsoever. Right? No advantage to it. And growing up, it was, in terms of our own family, in terms of our own house, it was never a question that we'd use any kind of word that was inappropriate. Just not an option. I remember, even I was, quite at a good age. I don't remember what age it was before I even realized what these words were or what they meant. Because there should be no space. There's no place where you will even be regarded as illiterate or not knowing things if you don't know what these words are. You see what I mean? In other words, like if you can't talk about the latest shows and the latest TV and this and that, then maybe your friends will say, oh, you don't know anything. But foul language, no one needs to know. There's no social utility for it. There's no worldly utility, no spiritual utility. It's completely nonsense. This is the word. This is why they're called expletives. That's the technical term for it. Expletives. It's because they have no meaning whatsoever. These are words which are free of meaning. The only thing that they do is they affect someone else. They have an offending effect. It's like if I were to walk up to you and give you a punch on the face. Right? What meaning did I have? Did I say anything to you? No. But I did something to you, right? I hurt you. The foul words are like an oral punch, basically. You do it with your mouth. It means absolutely nothing, except you're actually trying to hurt someone. That's all. Right? Using it. And people drop it in so many times, this foul language. You know, the American president, his name was Nixon, right? Famous American. He had to resign from power, right, because of all the scandals associated with him. But if you heard his transcripts, and this was part of what made the American public so convinced that this was a terrible guy, his every other word was full of these foul language expletives. He is president of the country, and when you heard the transcripts of his conversation, he was using these horrible words nonstop, constantly. And it practically lost him. Well, of course, he did his illegal things and activities. But it lost him so much popularity. People may use these words themselves, but no one respects someone who uses it. Even the person who uses those words themselves will not respect another person who uses that language. In under no circumstances will you garner any respect or popularity by using foul language. Everyone knows it's foul, everyone knows it's low class, even those who use it. And that's exactly why they use it, is because they know it's low class. And they enjoy being low class. Okay, one more on the girl's side here.
Prabhuji, I have one more question. When we hear someone talk bad about Krishna, what should we do?
Yeah.
Like our friends, they make fun of us if we practice Krishna. So what should we do to stop them talking bad about Krishna?
Okay, very good question. Excellent question. When a devotee, it says in the scriptures that when someone criticizes a devotee, when a devotee is criticized, when you are criticized yourself, then in a situation like that, a devotee is very humble. and doesn't retaliate. But when one hears criticism of another devotee, or hears criticism of the spiritual master or of Krishna, then a devotee is not humble. Then a devotee is not weak in that circumstance. And basically we have several options. Two options, two main options. One, we should try to defeat them. If they're saying something bad about Krishna, we should try to argue against them and try to convince them that what they're saying is not correct. That's not right. If we are unable to do that for whatever reason, sometimes the person criticizing may be someone who is much more senior or powerful than us and we don't have any ability to speak up. Or a situation where the whole reason they're doing it is just to taunt you and they will not stop. Then in that situation it says that one should simply leave. So first we should try to make that person stop, help them to see the light of reason, right? Try to convince them by our own knowledge of scriptures, and if we cannot do that, then we simply leave the room. We avoid their association. And that sends a very strong message, very clear message. So many hands are there. Okay, Prabhuji, please. Yeah, they may use all kinds of language, right? Right. Yeah, they may use that foul language on a regular basis, right? But we have to develop our own habits. And try doing this, right? Every time you have the urge to use something like that or it comes in your mind, try to replace it with the word Krishna, right? And you see many devotees doing this. They get their toes stubbed and they go, "Oh Krishna!" And, "Oh Krishna! Oh Govinda!" Yeah? And immediately it'll come out, right? And that's beneficial for everyone, right? And maybe it'll send a message to your friends also, right? They'll hear, "This guy is weird, you know, weird." Yeah. So then you just emphasize it further. Be different. Just every time something comes to your mouth, practice saying Krishna. If it accidentally something bad comes out, then immediately say Krishna after that. That will help purify the mouth. And you'll get in the habit of saying properly. It affects us. It's not good association. That's a fact. Right? I'm speaking in terms of pragmatically, how to be in that association and try to make things better. But ultimately, any association which is constantly feeding us foul language and foul thoughts, that cannot be good association for us. You see what I mean? So that we have to acknowledge. Now, one has to be honest with oneself. I mean, you have to be honest and say, okay, I know this is not the best of association. However, I still don't have the strength to give it up completely. Right? So I will be here and try to make the best use of a bad bargain and try to be as Krishna conscious as possible in the situation. Right? My father has something to add here. It was on.
I try to use this in my preaching in the U.S. I tell people that in the Vedic India, even our foul language had names of Krishna. So the example is, I don't know how many of you used it, but I'll tell you anyway. When I was a child, I will use, or my father would say, harami. And there's the word ram in it. And because the word is pure, it does have the same effect, even though it's used the wrong way. Or, no, and I'll give you another example in a minute. Or we say, you know, So he was trying to give them a message. If you don't stop it, you're going to be a dog in the next life. So we meant what we said, and we were asking Krishna's help. We're never on this sort of personal body language, right? It is said, and this is a question that I have for you, I don't want to divert, that Saddam Hussein, when he was given the, you know, the execution, right? What were his last words? They were almost same as what Gandhi said. Because they were taunting him, and so it is said that he said, "You're all haramis." So now for them it's a bad word. In Islam you can ask anyone. But when you look from the perspective, he uttered the word Ram, even in anger or even that way. So what I'm saying is, really, if you go back and look at the whole system, even in our worst anger and the worst things, we try to think of Krishna. I don't know if it makes sense or not. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I just received a question on paper here. Oh, by the way, yes, that's a nice point. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says the same thing, that the Muslims, they chant haram, haram, and in this way they get benefits. Like that.
In some ways, if you find this in public, devotees sometimes do not get upset as much as the others do. There's that famous incident that when Prabhupada was here in America, I believe the Wall Street Journal published a very negative story about Hare Krishnas. Now, Wall Street Journal, if you do not know, is the most widely read newspaper in the country, and especially by the intelligent class, business class, all businessmen. And they had a very negative article about Hare Krishnas. The devotees were very upset. And they went to Prabhupada and they were suggesting all sorts of things, that they should go protest, they should go write letters to the editor, this and that. And Prabhupada was very calm. He said, he asked a suggestion, he said, that many people have uttered the word Krishna, or they have seen the word Krishna. So he said, Krishna's name is absolute, and it will have a positive effect. So when something really is out of your control, you can still keep your peace of mind with saying, okay, even in their anger, they've been reminded of Krishna. So like the Mataji was talking about, what if someone is taunting? If they're taking the name of Krishna, and that comes with a lot of faith and understanding, that Krishna's name is absolute. Now, it doesn't mean that you're going to go out and, you know, abuse the name of Krishna, but somebody else is doing it, he's still benefiting it. Okay, so that at least provides to me comfort, because living in the USA, I probably get as many tauntings and comments, and I cannot do much because I'm myself an immigrant. You know, I'm a disadvantage, and so what comforts me, first it teaches me tolerance too, it says that they are benefiting. Okay? Does it make sense?
Yeah, thank you. There's one question I received on a piece of paper here. It seems like it's from one of the parents. It says, thank you for encouraging the children and enlightening them. Could you please explain how you opted to be non-rebellious during your teenage? Thank you so much. So I can just give you a small anecdote from my own experience. When I turned 13 years old, the first teenage years, then I remember I was studying some Sanskrit with my Sanskrit teacher. He was an American, very nice person, very knowledgeable about languages. And that day he was teasing me. He said, oh, your birthday is coming up. I said, yeah. He said, how old will you be? I said, 13. He said, oh, 13. Oh, that's not good. No one will like you anymore. And I said, really? Why? He said, you're a teenager. You won't like anyone either. I said, really? He said, yeah, teenage years are like that. They're horrible years. You can't get along with anyone. No one can get along with you. And I thought, I remember that day, yeah, I've heard this song. Why does it have to be? I don't feel any different. I'm 12, tomorrow I'm 13. What's changed? Why just because I'm a teenager, no one will like me, I cannot like anyone? Why do we have this bad reputation as teenagers? I'm going to be sure that I'm going to change the trend. Like, I will act in such a way that no one even notices I'm a teenager. I'll be 100% non-rebellious. So that was my form of rebellion, I think, when I turned a teenager. I was like, I'm going to prove this society wrong, that why do teenagers have such a bad rap? Actually, we're okay. So teenage rebellion is kind of a natural thing, but the point is that rebellion can be channeled for very positive purposes. In other words, rebellion basically means an energy, a desire to do something revolutionary, right? We discussed this at the beginning. A desire to do something that's different, to be unique, to stand out in the crowd, right? This is what rebellion means. I'm not going to follow like these horses, you know, they follow one another back to back. I'm not going to do that, right? I want to be different. I want to be unique. This is the desire in someone who's a teenager, in that youthful age. And that can be actually very, very positive if it's utilized in the right way, right? If it's directed in the right way. These teenage young disciples of Srila Prabhupada, right? They were rebellious. And as a result of their rebellion, they joined the Hare Krishna movement and decided to change the world, right? Hanumanji, right? He was rebellious in a sense. Right? As a young child, he got cursed, therefore, by the sages. Right? But ultimately, he used that strength, that desire for change, revolution. He did something revolutionary for Lord Ramachandra by jumping across the ocean. Right? So that rebellious nature is simply a sign of a desire to do something extraordinary, to be unique, to not be like part of everyone else, the same thing, the same old, same old. And if we understand that really the way to be unique is to change the world, to do something revolutionary by preaching Krishna consciousness, by participating in Krishna consciousness, we can actually use our rebellious tendencies in His service. I think for myself, part of the whole thing of rebellion was just that we were the only ones who were devotees. Practically everyone around us were not devotees. Right? So for us, it was a constant state of rebellion. Everywhere we went, we were the odd ones out. People were saying, oh, you're Hare Krishnas, oh, you're Hare Krishnas. And we constantly had to explain who Krishna was and why we're different. And like my father saying, sometimes people would make fun. So our whole life was one of rebellion against the rest of society, so to speak. So as devotees, we're always in a state of rebellion. We're rebelling against the norms of Maya, right? The standards of Maya that everyone has. Everything has to be like this. So I don't think as devotee teenagers we have to go through any great serious rebellion. Right? Whatever feeling of rebellion we have, we should just use it to become even better devotees. And in this way, rebel against society, against mundane friendship, against a mundane civilization. And that's real rebellion. A rebellion for the good of the world.
So I do have a story in contrary to what he's saying. No, not contrary, but I think Paul, children rebel is because of the bodies growing up, so the hormones. So his was a little bit early. He may not remember, but about the age of seven or eight, he saw something really disturbing or weird, and not weird, but he was more excited and more not rebellious, but just not in his mind. And in fact, my wife said, "You know, Ravi is acting very funny." And so, so we said, "Well, you know." And so I still remember that we had him sit down and we chanted this Narsingha prayers for about 1 week every evening. And I said, Ravi, chant this. You know, and it seems like after about a week or so, he calmed down. So maybe one solution is you sit down and you just chant, Lord Narsingha Dev's prayers, and the ghost of hormones will go away, you know.
Very good. How much more time do we have? 10 minutes more. Okay. Okay. Yes. Over there.
Prabhuji, some.
Hmm? Okay. Why don't you ask the question, and then after that, my mother can say a few words. Yeah. Or if anyone has any questions specifically for her, then she can also answer them. But please go ahead, and then after that, my mother.
Prabhuji, sometimes suppose a devotee is being blasphemed, and another devotee uses foul language. So is this act proper or no?
No, it's not proper. And if we find ourselves in a situation like that, we can tell that devotee, very nicely, we can tell him, this is not good, this is not how devotees speak, this is not how devotees behave. Okay? And if that devotee is senior to us and we cannot speak like that to them, then we can go to some other senior devotee that we know, like our parents, and we can say, Prabhuji, this person is not speaking or behaving properly. And they will then deal with that person. Okay, so if it's someone equal to us, we can address it directly and we can tell them, no, no, this is not good, this is not how devotees behave, this is not how they speak. And if it's someone we cannot speak directly to, then we should go to someone who's our own senior and they can deal with it. Okay?
Hare Krishna, it's been very interesting to be here and hear everybody's questions and responses. And the only thing I can say is that I have to have my hats off to all of you, you know, parents and children, to be able to, you know, struggle through becoming a devotee in this, you know, in this society. I mean, it's been a long time since I've, you know, really actually heard what's going on here, and there's so much struggle to become a devotee here. And if you can do that, really, Krishna is really, really pleased. So I really want to applaud everybody, you know, in a very heartfelt way of the efforts that all of you are trying to be, you know, good devotee in today's circumstances. However, you know, we are doing so many seminars. I just looking at the state of condition today, I would still encourage parents and children to try to do some alternative ways to, you know, stop this, you know, being in this rat race and this horrible condition where sometimes it becomes absolutely impossible, as all of you have realized, to practice Krishna consciousness. And that's why we are, you know, we are kind of going around and trying to, you know, with the auspices of our Ministry of Educational Development, we're trying to find alternative ways where children can have some kind of decent childhood, you know. Because sometimes in this society, it's even hard to be just a gentleman and a gentlewoman. You know, it's so difficult. It's so, you know, to be even try to be saintly in this society. So, unless we had, I heard a wonderful class by Radhana Swami one time, is unless we have, you know, the facility, the children have the facility to, you know, an environment conducive to practice these things, even halfway, you know, it becomes a big struggle. So, you know, I would really just encourage parents to try to think of ways to, you know, to make priorities for their children, no matter how hard it is, where they can have more of a beautiful childhood, just like Krishna had in his childhood. So, thank you. That's all. The question is, how do you stop the boys from playing violent computer games? What strategy does one follow? So, I mean, for my children, while I was home educating them, these things didn't even occur to them, to play violent computer games. So in other words, these are the results of peer pressure and being out there and trying to keep up with everybody else and appearing smart along with everybody else. So all those pressures are there. But if we follow the principles that Srila Prabhupada asked us, you know, and follow his instructions and, you know, keep a Krishna conscious lifestyle, you know, to the best of our ability, then I think it's possible to keep away from all these violent things. So I hope all of you had gotten a chance to attend some of our seminars earlier, and we have a recording of that, and maybe it's a nice thing for children also to attend that, you know, to hear some of the things, and thereby they might be more cooperative in their, you know, with the parents, and the parents are more, you know, open to the idea of, you know, home education, or, you know, at least trying to start more schools that are more Krishna conscious schools, where our children can be more protected, in a more protected environment. In other words, we expose our children, but in a protected way. We don't try to expose them in this violent way, in this violent society. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all very much for your attention and for all your good questions and participation. This is the liveliest group of 13 to 18-year-old teenagers that I've ever spoken to. I felt so inspired myself just hearing all your questions and all your comments and experiences. I really felt a sense of friendship and camaraderie. Please continue in your efforts of Krishna consciousness, help each other, and also give your blessings to me that we can all progress together in Krishna consciousness and one day do great things for Srila Prabhupada. Jai. Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much. Let us thank the whole Gupta family by loudly chanting. Now that we have developed a very close relationship with all of them, I'm sure our kids can always be connected. Maybe you can avoid email to remain connected. But also one thing which I remember from His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj's lecture, and I suppose it was given in Gopal's garden itself, he said if there is any important service for parents, the most important service actually, then it is taking care of their children. He says there is no other more important service, and I see that Prabhuji and Mataji have done that service so nicely, because children are dependent, and the result is right over here, bright future of ISKCON. So anything we need to say? No? Sunday feast lecture?
Radhika Raman Prabhu is giving a Sunday feast lecture along with his parents. So after the children's program, you can all go and sit and hear him speak Krishna conscious philosophy. He started speaking Krishna conscious philosophy, preaching when he was 12 years old. It's already late for us, but at least we can start learning and do the same. Hare Krishna. And he's going back today, and we are really grateful for his coming here along with his parents. He just came for 4 days. He's going back to America to teach in the colleges. He has taken really, you know, a lot of trouble to come here. So we can actually be grateful to him by implementing some of the things what he has told. If we can implement everything, that will be really grateful. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.